I got it going. Thanks, Elisa. Okay. All right, so you read the very first chapter of the qualitative data book, Getting into Qualitative Research. And I like the way that the authors used the opportunity to contrast what most of you are already familiar with, which is quantitative research, you know, hypothesis testing research, with this idea of hypothesis generating research. So the analogy is like, you know, qualitative researchers are like Lewis and Clark. You know, they're going across the country and they're trailblazing and they're creating new trails. They're seeing new sites. They're exploring lands that no one's ever seen before, right? And then pioneers come and they follow the trails blazed by Lewis and Clark, and they set up, you know, villages and outposts and with the Conestoga wagons, and you know they're settling the West. So qualitative researchers are like Lewis and Clark. You know, they're exploring areas that have not been researched yet. You know, how can you test a hypothesis based on very little experience? So they often rely on their experience with their Haitian father's study, right? So I've met Carl Auerbach and Louise Silverstein. Neither one is Haitian. Well, Carl is a father, but he's not Haitian. Louise is neither a father nor Haitian. So how would they possibly test hypotheses about Haitian fathers when they don't know a damn thing about Haiti, Haitian culture, or fatherhood? You know, it doesn't make any sense. So the first step is to go into a subculture like Haitian fathers, right? And you interview them and ask them, well, what's it like being a Haitian father? Tell me what's going on with that. Tell me what your challenges are, what the opportunities are, what it feels like. You know, give me a bird's eye view of Haitian fatherhood, right? And they go in and they conduct hour-long interviews with groups of six Haitian fathers. And does anyone remember what the one insight they had that they mentioned in this chapter was that they had no clue about before?
Religion.
Say more.
They didn't know much about like what can be like important factors for the fatherhood in Haitian. Like, yeah, so they started interviews with a bunch of fathers, and most of them mentioned something like religions, how religion influenced the way they react or treat their children, or exactly the way they think their fathers would be.
Exactly. So spirituality, religion, right, played a large role in their role of fatherhood. Mm-hmm. So how they felt about God, about their spirituality, deeply influenced their relationship with their children. That is something that Auerbach and Silverstein hadn't anticipated. That was an unanticipated finding. Why? Because Auerbach and Silverstein are not that religious, and American culture, which is the culture that Auerbach and Silverstein grew up in, and some of us here have grown up in, is very secularized, right? I think you might know this stats, Justin, less than half the American population goes to church anymore, or
less than that,
much less than half, right? So we're a secular society. In Haiti, I've never personally been to Haiti, but I've been to the West Indies, Trinidad, Puerto Rico. You know, religion is a very important part of the culture. Whether you're talking about Haitian culture, which has a French bearing, Puerto Rican culture, which has a Spanish bearing, Trinidad, which has vestiges of British colonialism, regardless, these three, these countries that I've been to anyway, you know, religion is, plays an extremely important part in the daily rhythm of the lives of the people who live there. And that's true for, certainly true for Haiti. Very different from this culture, this American culture. So Auerbach and Silverstein were surprised. Oh, we never thought that religion would have been something that would emerge from our studies, our qualitative research. So now you can actually formulate a hypothesis about religion that can be tested in a later quantitative study. But the qualitative research actually surfaces these concerns that otherwise would have gone completely unnoticed. So that's why qualitative research can be very important in understanding, you know, a phenomenon. Like Haitian fatherhood. Yeah.
The literature review is the is an alternative to this. Right? I mean, when I was doing my thesis, I mean, that's what we, how we generated our hypothesis was through a literature review. We just tried to read out as much. So, I mean, with due respect to what they did, I mean, I also think if you had read something on Haitian fathers, you know, you might have discovered that. Or, you know what I mean? Like, I think
if there was much literature on it.
If there was, yeah.
I mean, how many people study Haitian fathers?
I don't know, but I also think it's not that far out of the imagination to think that a Caribbean culture, you know, the less developed the culture, the more religious that culture is likely to be. I don't know. I mean, I feel like I get it, but at the same time, I mean, doesn't seem argumentative.
No, but I mean, this, we could ask the same question of the...
Yeah, I mean, there's always the thing you don't think to ask, though.
Yeah, I mean... There's a voluminous literature on addiction, mm-hmm. like massive. There is a very, very large literature on food addiction. Mm-hmm. And if you want to stretch it out to like binge eating disorder, you know, there's a lot.
Yes.
Sex addiction, there's plenty of research about that too. But what's missing? From my reading of the literature, I know more about the sex addiction literature than the food addiction literature, but what's missing is first-person accounts and studying those. Like what often happens is it's a top-down model where the researcher comes in, they give a bunch of questionnaires to sex addicts or food addicts, and then they analyze the data, rather than sitting down and getting to know what it's like to be a sex addict, what helped them,
yes.
And what is their life like now that they are in recovery? Mm-hmm. That kind of thing you don't see as often. You might see it in some of the literature, but much less often.
Point well taken.
So this is an approach that would allow us to explore first-person accounts. Now, for us to do this research exactly the way Auerbach and Silverstein do it, we have to actually go out and collect interviews. And we're just not going to do that in 1 year, right? That's a multi-year project to collect, you know, 20, 30, 40 participants in each of these two categories, and then do interviews, and then learn the coding system. You know, like, I'm trying to find research projects that we can reasonably complete in a year's time, like the one we did last year with the scores. That we finished in a reasonable time, and we had a final product that was presentable at the APA conference in August of last month, actually. You know, we were able to do that, and we did a good job with that. So to do that, we have to cheat a little bit and rely on text rather than interview, and then transcribe, and it's a whole long process. It's like a dissertation, really. This is a shortcut. We're not interviewing anybody. We're not asking them questions that might be specifically designed to address like your questions about fantasy versus reality, or my questions about the role of spirituality in their transformations. But I'm hoping that in the stories they've written that we'll be able to glean from these stories answers to the questions that we might have. And I'm pretty sure we will find material. I'm pretty sure about that. So that's what hypothesis generating research is, as opposed to hypothesis testing. And I think the Haitian Fathers analogy works. And the idea that they surfaced this idea of religion, which actually up to that point hadn't been in the literature at all. So I'm hoping that we can find something like kind of cool and neat that hasn't been studied quantitatively before. Maybe we will fail, but at least we'll get some posters out of it, right?
True.
So I'm going to entertain your questions. We've got 15 minutes. What questions did you have about the first chapter? Oh, so I don't forget. So next week we're going to have a bigger reading assignment. Because you guys owe me 6 hours a week. That's what you all promised. That's what you all signed up for. So the next three chapters, chapters 2, 3, and 4, we read for next week. So it's a little bit more reading. But I want us to move this along fairly quickly so we can get to the coding practice. And you'll need to read chapters 2, 3, and 4 to make sense out of my presentation next week. You're going to need to read those three chapters. So, anyway, didn't mean to interrupt. What questions did you all have about the first chapter?
The interviews were done in groups.
Yes.
4 to 6.
Right.
And then the interviewer was a Haitian person, man, I believe.
Yes,
as well.
Correct.
So would they just translate the story through that interviewer then? How would that?
So what happened is that they would actually video record every single group session that was held. And group sessions are a neat way to do it because then you get a group culture going, at least for that hour. But you don't have to do it that way. Later in the book, they describe the possibility of doing just individual interviews. And there are pluses and minuses of the individual versus group interview. The individual interview is nice because there's less fear factor. You know, like, especially when you're talking about addictions, you know, it's hard to talk in a group because there's so much stigma attached to addictions, especially sex addiction, right? Less so, but still, food addiction, it's definitely there. So meeting one-on-one preserves the self-esteem of the respondent. Group is a little bit more intimidating, but if it works well and it's not a stigmatizing topic, you can really get a lot more information sometimes from the group format. So it really depends on the nature of the subculture you're studying. I think in this regard, these individual stories are really nice because anonymity is completely preserved. Nobody knows who these people are. They're completely anonymous to us and to the public. And so they can speak freely because no one's going to ID them. So does that answer?
Yes.
Okay. So what else? What other questions? Yes.
Tell
me your name again.
Savannah.
Savannah, right.
Yes.
Okay.
Kind of bouncing off that question, they had mentioned that the majority of the groups were being interviewed by someone of the same culture, of the same level.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would have somebody else from outside that culture interview them. Was the purpose of that to involve inclusivity and then compare if there was bias? Like, what was the point of having a separate outsider come in and interview a similar group and have an interviewer of the same culture interview that group as well?
Well, I don't remember the outside interviewer.
There was one, there was like three native-born Latinos interviewed through the Latino samples, and
yep.
then the fourth was an American bilingual psychologist who came in to interview.
Oh, I think it was simply convenience. They didn't have a fourth Latinx person
mm-hmm.
available. But they did have a bilingual person who was not Latinx available.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was simply they didn't have a fourth. But certainly the preference, if I'm reading that correctly, the preference is to have someone within that culture do the interview, because it
is that similar to like the group where it's kind of like a camaraderie?
Yes.
Sense of like
I think it makes the respondent feel more at ease.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this person might have a better shot at understanding me than somebody from outside the culture. There are disadvantages of that too. We talk about this in psychotherapy research. You know, I'm heterosexual, but I treated homosexual men. Right, I go into that culture, and if they know that I'm married to a woman, they might have a harder time opening up because I might not understand. At the same time, let's say I were a gay man and I were treating a gay patient. That patient might make some assumptions about what I know and don't know about gay culture that I may or may not know, even though I'm gay. Right, I might not know that. So they might not talk about it in as much depth, so you might not get as much information from the patient about gay culture, whatever that means, right? Than somebody who's from outside. So if I'm an outsider, so I'm a heterosexual man, I walk in and I play dumb. I don't know anything about gay culture. Teach me. And then they have to like spell it all out. I'll learn more about that person being an outsider. So clearly, Auerbach and Silverstein's point of view is, if you're a member of that culture, it's certainly advantageous for this qualitative method. I would argue that yes, there are advantages, but there are also disadvantages. If you're an outsider and you play dumb, and the person accepts your dumbness, right, and takes on the role of teacher or instructor, that can also be very helpful. So I see the pluses and minuses of that. But they tend to prefer the interviewer coming from that same culture. And I can definitely see the pluses in that.
I think there might be a risk of like thinking that you know too much, like that I already know.
Absolutely,
that.
Yes.
Like if you are an insider, you might hear the narrative of a fellow insider, but like filtered through your own experience, such that you just hear it in a specific
absolutely.
Way. So
absolutely.
So I think there could be some advantages to not being
no,
too much of an insider.
I hear you. I think the way around that, the methodological solution for that is your video recording it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you have somebody from outside who's transcribing just what they hear. And then you have coders who may or may not be part of that culture, who are actually doing the coding. And the coding is fairly straightforward and doesn't necessarily rely on being a member of that culture or not being a member of that culture.
Right.
It's basically underlying what's known as relevant text, and we'll get into that next week. But certainly you're doing the interview. You
right.
come with biases.
More
yes,
like
yes.
But yeah, so the coding kind of pulls you out in a more objective, you know, it's like it gets underlined or it doesn't get underlined.
Yes, yes. You smell the incense?
Yeah.
I love it.
What's going on? I mean, is it like a
this is a chapel, right?
Well,
so
yeah.
They're having a service up there, I imagine. Is that
it's just
there?
Like Wednesday. What, is it a holy feast day or something?
Usually Wednesday evenings is a pretty common worship time.
Oh.
I don't know what service this is, but
I don't remember from last week, but this is a regular thing, that's great. So what other questions do we have about the chapter?
It's interesting, like religious belief as a variable is interesting to look at, because I feel like there's not a lot of like literature out there on religiosity. anyway. There's a lot of like ethnicity and race,
mm-hmm.
but I feel like a lot of, maybe I haven't read enough literature, but I don't see it as like a common trend. Like for generalizability, they usually have to have all of ethnicities or races kind of
right.
used, right? But is religion considered in that publishing or no?
Certainly less than ethnicity. It's an open question. I mean, how much has been published about spirituality's role in the recovery of addiction? There's a literature on AA or 12-step programs in general, but you'd be surprised at how little 12-step programs have been studied, empirically. It's not a whole lot, and I would imagine there's very, I know the SA, the sex addiction literature better, because I'm a certified sex addiction therapist, so I'm familiar with that literature. There's only a handful of studies looking at the effectiveness of 12-step programs for sex addiction on recovery. So there's not a lot there. So I'd be surprised if there was a whole lot written about spirituality's role in recovery from sex addiction, or food addiction, overeating addiction, whatever you want to call it. That's something you could explore and report back to the group.
What about spirituality that's not affiliated with a religion?
Yeah, either affiliated or not affiliated, right?
I'm thinking about like yoga or something. You
absolutely,
know,
that's spiritual.
People who have kind of a spiritual
orientation.
Yeah, but they also might not have any affiliation with any religion.
True.
Or church.
That's why I use the word spirituality. I'm talking about more broadly speaking.
Yeah.
Right? I think we're going to have to think in broad terms when we're coding.
Mm-hmm.
Anything related to the sacred or the, things of ultimate concern, to use a term from Paul Tillich, underscoring those kinds of textual elements would be important. Anything else? Call it a day. All right. See you next week. So the next three chapters, 2, 3, and 4. All right. Very good. Thank you. You were so quiet today, Elisa. All right, so I'm going to try to figure this out for next week. I'm very sorry. At least you got to see everybody. But the facilities manager was here earlier, and she actually helped me set up the visual, but we didn't test the audio, and that was a mistake. So I'll get here a little bit early next week and try to solve this problem so that we don't have this problem again, okay? All right, so I'll see you next week. And did you get my, you can nod. Did you get my email message about the letter? Okay, great. All right. So I'll see you next week. Sure. All right, bye-bye.